Good morning. Welcome to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. Today's date is March 5th, 2026. And the first order of business will be to approve the minutes of the 3rd of March. Do I have a motion for moving the minutes, passing the minutes? Representative Curran.
So moved, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved. This morning, the first thing we're, I have to read the thingy. All right, going to read the safety notice. To ensure everyone can view, hear, and understand today's proceedings, we ask for your cooperation in maintaining decorum and civility throughout this hearing. For the safety, security, and comfort of all attendees, please note the following guidelines. Signs are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. Applause or other audible demonstrations are not allowed. Standing or sitting in walkways and aisles is prohibited. If you require any accommodations, please speak to the sergeant staff wearing the gold ties. State troopers and house security personnel are present to ensure everyone's safety. Those providing testimony will be given specific time limits, which must be strictly observed. If you receive an entrance ticket, please retain it as it may be required for re-entry if you leave the hearing room. Failure to comply with these guidelines may result in the removal from the hearing room. Our goal is to conduct this hearing efficiently while ensuring everyone has the opportunity to observe and participate appropriately. First on our agenda, we have a presentation by the courts. And please come to the testifiers table and go ahead, introduce yourselves. We're going to move House File 3874. Actually, Chair, leave me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I will move House File 3874 to be laid over for possible inclusion in a finance bill.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Please, the bill is before us. Please introduce yourselves and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Co-Chair Scott and Liebling. My name is Jeff Shorba. I'm the State Court Administrator for the Minnesota Judicial Branch and happy to be here with you this morning. Along with me is Judge Michael Fritz, who's the Chief Judge in the 7th Judicial District, and you'll be hearing from him shortly. So, just a reminder, I was supposed to push this button. Anna. This doesn't move it. Okay. So, just a reminder of the placement of the judicial branch in our Constitution. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution guarantees that people provided with justice have equal access for the fair and timely resolution of cases and controversies without denial, without promptly, and without delay. And so we are coming here today to talk briefly with you, but we wanted to start out by thanking you. We know it was a difficult session last session, and there were a lot of budgetary constraints, but you were willing to increase the hourly payment rate for our contract forensic examiners, develop a new justice partner system, which is well underway and will be launched shortly, covering the employer's share of health insurance costs and our lease costs at the Judicial Center, and increase in employee compensation, although only at the level of 0.9%. Unfortunately, we did not get any salary increases for fiscal year 27 for our staff, and no increases for judges for the 2 years. And we did have a healthy ask for juror per diem, and there was no money to do that as well. So just a preview, we may be back next session to talk with you further about some of these items, but thank you for what you were able to do. Given the uncertainty that we are having in the state, some of that maybe have been remedied a little bit by the forecast last week, but we understand that funding is tight and this is not a formal budget year, but our council has put forward a request for two items. One is some provisions to increase safety and security for our judicial officers and staff, and the second, to pay the employer share of the new Minnesota paid leave program. So I'll talk first briefly about safety and security, and then Judge Fritz will provide his comments, and then we'll talk a little bit about Minnesota paid family leave. Threats are on the rise, both nationally and in Minnesota, to all public officials, including judges and court staff. The tragic shooting of lawmakers last June has been felt throughout the judiciary. We are seeing similar threats come to play in other jurisdictions. In Indiana recently, a state judge was at home, knock on the door, and someone shot him and his wife when they answered the door, similar to what we saw last June. Luckily, he survived. The litigant felt like he did not want his trial to move forward and decided the best way to do that was to shoot the judge. Unfortunately, we see a lot of this reaction, not only to those kinds of situations, but decisions of judges where the response seems to be threats rather than appeals to the Court of Appeals. So you can see from the slide that total incidents are up 47%, threats are up 85%, and actual disturbances occurring in a court facility up by 50%. And so we are tracking those numbers, and we continue to see them rise year after year. So those numbers that I just talked about were 24 to 25. As a result, our top priority is to secure funding for a package of proposals that we believe will help improve safety and security of judicial officers. There are five components to the proposal, so I'll just briefly go through those five. The first is funding to provide personal data protection. This request would fund annual licenses for a service that continuously removes or masks personal information. We're modeling after this after things that the legislature is doing themselves for their members, I believe in the House and the Senate. This is something where we would work with a vendor to provide this protection on an individual basis for our judges and for our court administrators. The second involves home security, again modeled after some of the work already being done in the legislature. The dollar amounts here that you see on the screen are ones that are modeled after, I believe, the Senate ideas that they are implementing there. Judges will tell you that, especially if they have some kind of screening in their courthouse, they may feel safe there, but the problems occur when they go home. And we're seeing more and more threats directed at judges' residences and, unfortunately, judges' families. And so home security is something certainly on the mind of our judiciary. The next request is to seek two positions to supplement our judicial security unit. We operate in 103 locations across the state, and we have one person who helps coordinate security. And initially, she was hired to do things like continuity of operation plans and policy planning, but unfortunately now she's spending most of her time doing threat assessment analysis and working with the BCA and our local law enforcement. So we believe it would be helpful to have individuals with a law enforcement background who could help us to do those threat assessments. As you know all too well here, when you get a threat, the first question you ask if you're not a law enforcement person is, what should I do with this? How serious is it? What should I tell my family? Where should I take precautions? And unfortunately, even though we send all of ours to the BCA Fusion Unit, it takes a little while to get an answer. And so we believe having some staff who can help us with that, maybe not located here in St. Paul, but maybe on a geographic basis somewhere else, to look at those threats. The fourth component has to do with Chief Justice security. We're requesting funding to provide security for the Chief Justice when she goes to public events. This is not a security detail, as you find with the governor, but rather she attends about 80 to 100 public events every year, and we would like her to be escorted by somebody who can protect her, somebody with a gun. So this amount of funding, it's about $100,000, would permit contracting with the State Patrol or some other law enforcement to provide that protection when she is traveling to public events. And then finally, we are asking to resurrect our courthouse security grant program. We have done this on three other occasions. These are matching grants given out to the counties to shore up courthouses. As the number of threats go up, the counties are becoming more concerned about some of the courthouses around the state who could use some updates. And so we're asking for a one-time funding here of $1 million to provide grants to counties across the state. Here's an overview of the safety and security cost breakdown for each of these items going out into 28 and 29. You also, I believe, have in your packets some information provided by the Minnesota District Judges Association, who are also supportive of this request. And I will pause now and ask Chief Judge Fritz to provide any comments on the package.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Scott and Liebling, and members of the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. As introduced, my name is Michael Fritz, and I have the privilege of serving as the Chief Judge of the 7th Judicial District. The 7th Judicial District is made up of 10 counties, and it extends from St. Cloud to Moorhead. There are Becker County, where I am chambered, Benton County, Clay County, Douglas County, Mille Lacs, Morrison, Otter Tail, Stearns, Todd, and Wadena. We have 30 judges and one referee. I have been a judge for 12 years, almost 2 years as the chief judge of the 7th Judicial District. And before I was appointed to the bench, I was county attorney of Becker County for 7 years. And for 14 years, I served as an assistant Becker County attorney. Thank you for this opportunity to speak in support of the judicial branch's safety and security request today. As previously mentioned, and I believe it deserves highlighting again, over the past few years, the branch has seen concerning increases in total incidents reported of 47%. Threats to persons and property has increased by 85%, and reported disturbances occurring in court facilities has increased by 50%. These percentage increases are alarming, which is why our judicial safety and security request is so vitally important to the safety of judges and their families, court administration, and for the public that enter our courthouses every day across our great state. For perspective, there were 211 incidents reports filed statewide in 2024. In 2025, there were 310 incident reports made. That comes to nearly 6 incident reports per week. Just in the past 2 months, there have been 11 incident reports filed in the 7th District alone. Counting the one reported yesterday at 10:40 in the morning, we are at 12. That average is more than one per week, and if we continue at the same pace, the 7th District will have over 60 incident reports filed in 2026, which would double our 2025 number. State Court Administration Office currently has one person that intakes and responds to these incident reports. In many incidents, individual chief judges are attempting to help with the responses, or the individual judge is left trying to figure out measures to keep themselves and their families safe. Gaining two experienced persons with law enforcement backgrounds would greatly assist with threat assessments, threat responses, coordination with law enforcement, training, and emergency planning. In my combined 32 years as a lawyer and judge, I have never experienced the level of hostility and the number of threats that exist today towards judges and their families. Judges face threats that are more personal and vindictive in nature because the decisions we make commonly impact on a person's freedom, family, and/or finances. We decide cases and controversies daily where the parties are asking that we rule in their favor. Our decisions can invoke strong emotional reaction, including anger when our ruling is contrary to the party's request. Anger can escalate into threats, intimidation, and/or harassment. A judge in my district had a litigant in a contested custody proceeding discover where the judge lived and came to the judge's home during the workday while the judge's daughter was in the home. The litigant was recorded on a doorbell camera berating the judge, and the judge's child was home and had listened to that. Fortunately, the child didn't go to the door, and fortunately, the individual left without further incident. And I'm just going to interrupt right now and just say this may sound clunky as I go through this because I keep referencing the judge. I'm not naming the judge. I'm not naming the county, and I'm not naming a pronoun for it. I reached out to each judge that I will be discussing here today with some of these incidents and asked for their permission to tell a bit of their story, and I'm not including all the details because we don't want to really reignite the flames again. And so I apologize if it does sound clunky coming out. Another judge left in the middle of a judicial conference immediately after being informed that a litigant in a contested custody matter was asking court administration staff for the judge's address. On a previous occasion, that same litigant had been observed in the area where the judge parks at the courthouse. The judge did not want his family home alone in the event the litigant learned of the home address. And the event was so concerning, the judge felt it necessary to provide identifying information of the litigant to the child's school bus driver. And the law enforcement also notified the liaison officer at the child's school as well. Persons asking court administration staff for personal information about a judge is a common occurrence. Where do judges park? Where does a judge live? What time does the court day end? All are examples of reports I have heard before. Home security, online masking, and expanded judicial security unit would enhance the safety and security of judges and their families. In one county, two judges' homes have been repeatedly surveilled by drones. One incident, the judge was woken up at approximately 2 a.m. in the morning by a family pet. When the judge opened the door to let the dog out, there was a drone right in front of the door, approximately 10 feet off the ground. The drone activity continued on a number of occasions over a period of time, and not at a distance of 400 feet, which I believe is the federal regulation of how far they have to be away from residences. The surveillance was low and flying low. During one incident, the law enforcement was able to make it to the residence with a chase drone. However, due to the size and speed of the suspect drone, they were never able to catch it. Law enforcement reported that the drone was not the type of drone that a teenager would have. They estimated the cost in the thousands of dollars. Judges have had their private phone numbers discovered by litigants. One judge received repeated threats and intimidating comments like, "I know where you live, I'm coming to your home." The calls were constant for a period of 15 minutes, even after the judge had hit the reject button. It did not stop until the judge handed her phone over to a Hennepin County deputy. And this was a judge from my district who was at a conference in Minneapolis here, a judicial conference, when these calls started. The litigant had made multiple concerning threatening comments in four different counties. There were five different law enforcement agencies involved initially conducting their own investigations response until it was discovered he was a litigant in those other four counties. Another incident involved multiple counties in multiple districts involving three different law enforcement agencies, including the FBI. In both cases, an expanded judicial security unit and intake process with a coordinated response would have likely reduced hours of investigation and a faster threat response. Judges have experienced social media online doxing and threats of doxing. In one instance, due to the nature of the online threats and threats to be at a judge's home on a particular date at a particular time, a date and time when that judge was going to be on vacation with family, the chief of police was so concerned that he removed the judge's mailbox from its post so the address wouldn't be as easy to find. And the chief of police parked his personal pickup truck at the bottom of the judge's driveway so nobody could gain access to the driveway and to the home. These are but a few examples, and I don't have to repeat today other disturbing and threatening incidents described in the MDJA's position paper that I'm sure you have all received by now. And I could go on sharing other incidents with you. However, I'm fully aware that as elected officials, you understand and appreciate the need for and importance of keeping judges, their families, court administrators, and the public safe. The measures identified in our request will aid in strengthening security at critical points, judges' homes, courthouses, and online environments. And I respectfully ask that you support the judicial branch's safety and security request. Thank you once again for this opportunity to testify on this very important funding request.
Thank you, Chief Judge. Thank you for being here and for sharing those stories with us. What are we doing next here? Okay, I think, Mr. Schorber, you're going to go ahead with the remainder of the slides.
Yeah, so the last part of our supplemental request has to do with the cost of Minnesota paid leave. As you're all aware, this went into effect in January of 2026. There is an employer share of the cost that has to be paid by the employer. The judicial branch did not receive any funding at the last session to pay for this. There was some funding that was given through negotiations at the end of session to the other branches of government. We are not here to debate Minnesota paid family leave. We're just here to see if we could have a little bit of a fairness thing here with some funding to the judicial branch as well. Anytime we get these mandates, we comply with them. They're the law. But this amount of money is not something that we can easily absorb. We're 90% people in the judicial branch. So right now we are having to figure out how to hold positions open to pay the cost of Minnesota paid leave. So that is our supplemental funding request, and I will pause there before I move on to policy proposals.
Thank you, Mr. Schorba. We'll move on now to member questions. Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And like you said, we're not here to debate family leave. I want to know why we're funding, what makes you different than for instance, I've just met with the Congress of Minnesota Resorts up there. Small employers, one, two employees, they can't come to us and ask for funding, extra funding for this. What makes this different? Why can't you just absorb the cost like you're expecting all of our businesses to do, or we're expecting all of our businesses to do?
Mr. Schorba.
Chair Scott, Representative Bliss, that certainly is a legitimate question. We know that there are a lot of other places who are burdened with some of the costs here. I would just say two things. One is, again, the fairness issue. If it was good enough for the legislature and the executive branch to receive funding, I don't know why the third branch of government was kept out of that. We had initially put together an estimate that went to MMB, thinking that MMB would try to find funding for this, but that did not go through, and instead there were some deals made at the end of session that helped the other two branches, and to be honest with you, we were not in the room. So we did not have access to the decision makers in that. Second point I'll make is we are part of state government, and this is a mandate of state government, and I think it's only fair that if the state government is going to mandate this, that every branch, if they're going to get funding, receive funding for it. So that's why we have the ask.
Thank you, Mr. Schorba. Follow up to that?
Just one comment. Yeah, I agree with your statement. If the state government mandates it, they should fund it. So I'd like our small businesses to follow the same. Thanks.
Very fine. Representative Steer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So one question, you're going to have to walk me through this threat process. So judge received a threat. It goes into one person who's taking all these threats and vetting them. Why are we not using local police and sheriff's offices for this?
Mr. Sharba.
Chair Scott, Representative Steer, we are. We're trying to send them not only to the Fusion Center, but also we do have discussions then with local law enforcement and trying to coordinate with local law enforcement how to get a response back to the judge or to the staff member who got the threat. And that takes coordination. And as Chief Judge Fritz says, sometimes that coordination with local law enforcement is done by the chief judge, who obviously has other things to do as well. And so we'd like to have better coordination, because the other example he gave you is we may know this guy from Carver County or Ramsey County, and now something's showing up in Stearns County. And so we could better coordinate that with especially some people with law enforcement experience, but that's how we do it right now. It's a little haphazard.
Representative Steer.
All right, thank you for that. Just since I have the floor, on 2.27 of this one, so you're giving the State Patrol the same peace officer authority as a local police or sheriff. I just want to ensure that we're giving them training for this. State Patrol troopers are trained in 169, so that's your traffic code, and local police and sheriffs are 169 and 609 criminal code. So we're asking the state troopers to do criminal code when they've never been trained on how to act or respond to criminal code. So if there's a funding piece we can do here, or talk to the State Patrol to ensure that the troopers that are going to be assigned to this actually have the training to enforce it, that would be great.
Thank you, Representative Steer. Mr. Schwarber, any comment on that?
Chair Scott, Representative Steer, I think that's an excellent point, and we are currently talking with the State Patrol about this. You're correct. Some of them are trained differently, especially the ones who provide services to the governor, and so we might want to use some of that. We are testifying Monday in the Transportation Committee, and I'm sure we'll get a question like that. And obviously, those would be the right venues to see if there's additional training costs that we don't know about.
Thank you. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of comments. The stories that you shared really are terrifying, and we appreciate the role of judges in the judicial branch so much. So, I'm sorry that you're going through that. We also are going through that. One of my teenage son's friends like did a ding-dong ditch in our house in the middle of the night, and it was so terrifying. My daughter like slept in our bed. So, and it was just the stupid teenagers. So anyway, I'm just sorry for what judges are also going through. I also wanted to just make a comment on the paid family medical leave. I'm a small business owner, and you know, if we have to absorb cost, so far it hasn't really had an impact, but to the extent we do, like the impact is like maybe I can't buy more fancy shoes. When you have to absorb cost, what it might mean is that people don't have access to justice, and that people are not having their constitutional rights met by the judicial branch. So I do think that the investment in my shoes does not equate to the investment that we make in the judicial branch. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Judge Fritz, I also want to just express my solidarity with you, I guess would be the right word, and with all of the judges. And, you know, I often think that as elected officials, of course, we experience a lot of the same, but I can't imagine it's to the degree that judges do because of the very reasons you put forward. You're making somebody mad almost every day. Every case, somebody's going to walk away disappointed, most likely. And so there's a lot of potentially angry people. And I just want to express, first of all, that we really appreciate that about the work that judges do. And it truly is public service. You know, we appreciate that. And I hope that Minnesotans broadly really appreciate that. That said, I just have a few questions about the proposal that has been put forward here. I do think that having somebody in the judicial branch to sort of be that liaison person and to help with threat assessment and all that is an excellent idea, and I had a meeting with the Chief Justice about that issue. But I kind of recall that she was talking about one additional person. Maybe I misremember that. But I'm just really wondering, honestly, it seems really picky to even ask this question, but we're in such a thin budget time. So why two instead of one? And my sort of second thought about that is, if it was two, whether one of those could be somebody who kind of doubles as somebody to accompany the Chief Justice some of the time, if that's something that the branch views as a priority. So maybe you could address that.
Mr. Shorba.
Sure, Madam Chair, Chair Liebling. We were looking at other jurisdictions, other states, to see what they are providing in terms of judicial security, and we came up with two because of the number of threats when we compared them with some other jurisdictions. And your point, which I don't think is a bad one, is possible if we get two positions that one could accompany. We'd obviously want somebody who is licensed to carry a firearm and has the ability to use it in a way that would potentially protect the Chief Justice, but I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility if we're going to be looking for someone. That's a very good idea.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you. And let me just say, too, that I, as I understand, the position you're looking for is someone who would be kind of a bit comparable to what we have here with Lori Hodapp, who's our, what's her title?
Sergeant at Arms.
Thank you. Yeah, so she functions that way for us here in the legislature, and you know, that's been extremely beneficial to us. So I do think that could be a sort of a force multiplier, mm-hmm. if you will, to really help help figure out what to do in each of these situations and more broadly. Let's see. I also did want to ask you on the paid leave front. To explain, you know, we did have the full budgeting process last year. I know that it was a thin budget. I mean, from my point of view, I felt, you know, we were able to do some things for the judicial branch. You know, we kind of worked on what were your priorities and we tried to be fair with the limited budget we had across all the agencies that we fund here. And I know that it was thin. But we did not hear anything in your budget request about the need to do the paid family leave employer portion. And I think it was well known at the time that was coming. I mean, you've mentioned you went to MMB with that. And I don't know, why did you not come to us with that request? Was that something that you were led to believe would come another direction? Or because this would be the committee where I assume we would be funding that.
Mr.
And I
Shorba.
Think we would have funded it, to be quite frank.
Mr. Shorba.
Chair Scott, Chair Liebling. As I mentioned, we worked very closely with MMB, followed their guidelines for calculating what the amount would be to the judiciary. It's a pretty straightforward math equation, percentage of salary in the branch. And then we were led to believe that since all of state government was going to tackled this problem, it would be a massive bill rather than going to each particular committee to try to fund it. And so that's what we did. And I don't think each committee did fund it. I think what happened is in final negotiations, what is called, and I don't really know exactly what it is since we don't get it, but operational adjustments were given to two branches of government to deal with things like this rather than the judicial branch. We did not get any operational adjustment money. So for some reason, and again, we weren't in the room, the decision was made to fund this in a different way and not to give it to us. And we didn't find out about that till the show was over. So that's why we're in this position. I wish that we had sort of done some insurance and come to you separately and not just relied on what we thought the process was going to be, that lesson learned for future. But that's what the situation was.
Chair Liebling.
Well, thank you for that. You know, I think that was really an error. And I mean, for my past experience in different committees, the operational adjustments do come to the committees, whether they're granted, you know, obviously at the end of the day, there's a grand budget agreement between the House, Senate, and the governor. But if it doesn't filter up from the committees, oftentimes it doesn't exist. And I do want to say on the record that I am concerned about the judicial branch being left out. And, you know, as legislators, we have leadership that goes in and negotiates for us at the end. But we're not just abdicating our role to our leadership. They answer to us, at least this is my view, right? We as legislators, we don't elect leadership and then work for them. They work for us. And so if we are to be advocates for the judicial branch has to come and tell us what you need so that we can be advocates for you. It is very distressing to me that you're left out of the negotiation at the end. And I think the people on this committee and in the committee in the Senate that is the Judiciary Committee, we are the legislators who most closely should be understanding of the judiciary and its important role and that it is a separate branch of government, and we have to be the advocates for you. Mm-hmm. So I hope that in future we can work ever more closely together. We may not always agree with you. In fact, you know, I'm sure some of the requests here that you're making today, we may not agree with all of it. But nevertheless, the importance of your role and the fact that you need to be at the table, absolutely. And, you know, please do call on us to be in that role so that we can do it for you. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. And I just want to say, Mr. Sherb, I want to thank the Chief Justice. She reached out to me after the fact and expressed her disappointment of not being invited to the table by the governor. That's a huge oversight on his. If there's no oversight or intentional, I can't, you know, I don't know what was happening in those final hours. But to leave your branch out of those talks, there's some righteous indignation there. And so I hope that won't happen again. And I do urge you to come to us with those kind of concerns. And before we move on to the policy pieces, I just want to say, and Representative Feist, love ya, have great respect for you, but this is so much more than a difference of buying a new pair of shoes, this paid family medical leave. I hear about this issue everywhere I go, church, Target, Walmart, chambers of commerce. It's a huge burden on our, particularly on our small businesses. And I to equate it to just a simple pair of shoes, it's just life and death for a lot of these businesses. And because not only do they have to help fund this, but they have to get somebody to backfill when that employee is out up to 20 months out of the year. So I just want to put that on the record. And Mr. Sherb, let's go ahead. What we're going to do right now is lay this bill over, and then we will move on to House Bill 3874 is laid over, and we will move on to 3875. And this is the policy bill. And Chair Liebling, it looks like there is an amendment. Would you like to move that amendment? Is it A1?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I would move House File 3875 to be a laid over for possible inclusion in a policy omnibus bill, something, committee bill. And I would move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape in which we would like it to be heard. And I would ask maybe if staff could explain the amendment. I think Mr. Johnson, maybe, were you? I don't know who.
This is the policy piece.
I'm happy to do it. The courts may also prefer to address it.
Do you want to have Mr. Sherb?
Okay, Mr. Sherb, could you explain the amendment?
Go ahead, sure. Mr. Sherb.
Madam Chair, so the amendment has to do with the one of the policy proposals, which is publication of in newspapers or not newspapers, and staff attorneys pointed out that there might be other parts in statute where we wanted to have this language included so that it was not all just in one place, but there were other parts that needed to be included. So what the amendment does is it adds some other provisions in statute. It doesn't change the whole tenor. The point of this is that we would have a alternative way to publish notices, which would be on our website. So it's just a cleanup of different parts of statute that might be affected.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Johnson, did you have anything to add to that?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Chair Liebling, I think that's an accurate description. Currently, there are very specific requirements related to publication that require the use of a newspaper in most situations. This would allow the courts to publish things on their website instead of relying on publication in a newspaper.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. All those in any discussion on the A1? If not, all those in favor of adoption of the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Mr. Schorber, if you want to go ahead with the remainder of your PowerPoint on the policy side.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So our policy bill has 7 provisions, and I will just walk through those provisions and then certainly answer any questions that I can about those provisions. The first one has to do with jury composition. We had a jury task force that made a number of recommendations that they thought might improve the diversity of our juries. One of them you heard last session, which was to increase the jury per diem, which I already mentioned. But they also thought that there might be some ways to look at information that might help us to better put together our jury source list of potential jurors. So there are 2 parts to this provision. One is the way that we develop and summon jurors are by 3 sources of information. One is voter ID, one is state ID, and one is driver's license. Some states have also decided that they might get a broader pool if they look at tax records. Now, if somebody's not in a driver's license system and is not voting, maybe they're paying taxes, maybe they're not paying taxes. We don't want to change that without knowing what the impact would be. So what we're asking for here is to reach some kind of agreement with the Department of Revenue so that we could look at how those tax records might expand the jury pool, not to put it in place, more like a research project to see if it's going to make a difference. And then if we think it will, we'd come back to this committee and debate that at some other time. The second is to look at Department of Public Safety, race and ethnicity data. Right now, when we put out a summons, as returning the summons, we ask you to voluntarily provide race and ethnicity data. The Department of Public Safety does that when you apply for a driver's license, and we'd like to be able to compare that data. Because when you get a challenge to a jury, the question really is the jury representative under the Sixth Amendment? And it's a really sort of a data thing. And we think this data might help us show whether we're doing a good job or whether we're not doing a good job. And again, not putting it into place, not requiring them to give it to us forever, but to take a look and see what difference it would make in our jury pool. So that's the first provision in the policy bill. The second is to increase the no-fault arbitration limit. The limit is currently $10,000. It has not been increased in 25 years. And no-fault arbitration cases involve medical expenses, automobile expenses. Both of those have gone up significantly in 25 years. So we would try to increase it here to $20,000. If we were going to use just inflation, we'd be looking probably at $35,000, but this would put it at the same level as conciliation court limits, which this legislature has already increased. And we're not debating whether no fault's a good thing. It's a mandatory law here in Minnesota. We just want to make sure that the limit matches what we're dealing with in terms of costs for these kinds of cases. The third has already been mentioned, which is to, we believe, modernize the way courts are doing publication. Right now, the statute requires notices to be published in a qualified newspaper. We believe there may be more efficient, effective ways to do notice. And so this would allow the courts to publish notice on our website, and we have developed a different place on our website to do that. The next provision has to do with simplifying the conciliation court process. Right now, there seems to be a disparity in how service is done under the conciliation court process. For conciliation court claims under $2,500, the court provides service. If they're over $2,500, the plaintiff provides service. We think this is a change that probably got lost somewhere, and we're trying to just make it clear that they're all done the same way, whether it's less than $2,500 or more than $2,500, that it's done by the individuals who are bringing the case. The next provision is notices in divorce and separations without children. Again, this is a workload issue right now. It requires us to notify children and family services if there is a divorce, whether you have children or not. Again, we think this is a error that never got changed, and we have met with people from the Department of Children and Families who has reviewed the language, does not have a concern, does not see why we have to do this notice when there are no children. The next provision is really one we think will help victims. If you get a restitution order and that order is in effect, it lasts for 10 years. If you have not had your restitution paid, right now under statute, you need to file a separate case and pay that filing fee. So we think this should be easier to do. And if it hasn't been paid, we would administratively extend the restitution order for the amount that has not been paid, rather than having people having to go back into court and file things. And then the last provision has to do with the Child Protection Council that was authorized by this legislature to look at child protection and maltreatment cases. They are putting together a final report. They met with thousands of people, heard thousands of surveys and other kinds of things, and they need a little more time to analyze the data, so they're asking to have until the end of the year. It'll probably come to the legislature before then, but they need a little more time to do their final report. So those are the policy provisions, and I am open to questions, comments, other thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Shorb. And before we move to member questions, Lisa Hills with the Minnesota Newspaper Association is on the list to testify. Please come forward, introduce yourself for the tape, and go ahead with your testimony.
Hey.
Go ahead.
Okay, good morning, co-chair and committee members, and thank you for letting me be here today. My name is Lisa Hills. I am the executive director of the Minnesota Newspaper Association. MNA is the trade association for Minnesota's 242 newspapers, from the Star Tribune to the Hanska Herald. This bill would eliminate the longstanding requirement that important notifications issued by the judicial branch be published in newspapers. Instead, those notices could be posted on the judicial branch website, and MNA does oppose this change. We don't disagree that Minnesotans access information differently now. This is why state law already requires that notices published in newspapers must also be posted on newspapers' website in front of any paywall so they can be seen and read by anyone. Notices are also posted on a searchable statewide public notice website maintained by the Minnesota Newspaper Association at no additional cost to the judicial branch. While there may be fewer newspapers in our state than there used to be, there are still 242 of them, and Minnesotans do read newspapers. 86% of Minnesotan adults read their local print or digital newspaper each month. We are confident that public notices disseminated in newspapers and on their websites are more likely to be seen by the parties who are the subjects of the notice or by friends and family who know the parties and can notify them than the notice posted only on the judicial branch website. Public notices placed in newspapers as a means of alternative service of process has been validated by decades of experience and practice. Making the kind of dramatic change post here could very well raise questions about the legitimacy of service and invite due process challenges. For example, what happens if the court's website experiences an outage? Will a notice requirement still be considered fulfilled if it's not viewed. And these aren't just hypothetical situations. Minnesota's judicial branch website experienced an outage as recently as February 20th, according to the court's social media accounts. Government websites, unfortunately, are frequent targets of cyber attacks. The Kansas court's website was down for nearly 3 months in 2023 because of a cyber attack. Publishing these notices on the judicial branch website greatly reduces the accessibility to them, as well as removes any proof of publication, which is critical to avoid challenges. Newspapers provide notarized affidavits of publication for public notices. Public notices in newspapers are a permanent record held by an independent third party. And what would serve as proof of publication if these notices were only posted to the judicial branch website? Rather than eliminating the publication requirement, M&A believes a more valuable discussion would be how to address the situation when there truly is not a newspaper available for publishing a given notice. There are also ways that M&A can assist the court with efficiencies. For example, we can provide a list of qualified newspapers by county, along with assisting with placement of their notices. The Newspaper Association assists other state agencies and public entities to place notices, and we continue to make ourselves available to the judicial branch to discuss how M&A can assist in making the publication process more efficient for the courts. We respectfully request the committee remove the section regarding public notice from the bill, and we look forward to working with you on a better solution. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the room that wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony, Ms. Hill. And we have a couple of members on the list. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you both. I want to ask why we are extending the Supreme Court Council on Child Protection for that report to be published. A year ago, actually more than a year ago, this was 2024, the Star Trib listed in an article that Minnesota's child protection system needs fixes, and this was amongst one of the top starting points. Why would we then delay that report? Is it to collect more data? Is there a specific reason, or do you guys need a more comprehensive approach to this, or what's been going on there?
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Ingen, very important point. This is a very complicated question that this council is trying to address, and I couldn't agree with you more. That is absolutely needed. The council tried to take a very comprehensive approach here. They met with stakeholders. They had 27 focus groups. They had got 1,800 responses, 302 pages of written comments to the questions that they put out. They received presentations from 30 subject matter experts, and it's really a question of trying to distill all of that information. That took a little time to go out to the community and have these sessions, maybe a little more time than it was estimated to happen, but they guarantee to me that they will get it done this year. They may get it done by summer. They will certainly get it done in time for the next legislative session to give all of you time to digest the report and to hear from the council. But they just need a little, they don't need any more money. They are just analyzing data and they want a little more time to do that. So that's the only point here. Thank you though.
Okay, thank you, Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had a couple of questions. The first one is related to the restitution provisions, which I think is a great suggestion. I just want to make sure that the judicial branch has also spoken to the Department of Public Safety about that. 611A, they have some, you know, people that work over there specifically with victims on restitution issues. And I don't know that we need to see this in the Public Safety Committee, but I do think it's important to at least have that conversation with DPS.
Madam Chair, Chair Mueller, I believe we have, but I will definitely go back and ensure that we've talked to the victim people. Yes, that's a great point.
Thank you.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just a concern I have about the Department of Revenue files. I guess I do have concerns about that provision. I understand, and it's obvious that we need to have jury pools that are reflective of our communities. It's constitutional. And I do think what you have on lines 2.17 to 2.18 is good, and I fully support that. I'm a little hesitant about getting those records from Department of Revenue. And I am wondering, the report that you mentioned, the task force that you mentioned, I'm curious, when was that filed? I'd love to see it. It probably was sent to me at some point, and I didn't see it. But I'm just curious the date that that was filed, if you know.
Chair Mueller, are you talking about the jury study?
Yeah.
Mr. Shorba.
Chair Scott, Chair Mueller. It was about a year and a half ago. It was done in anticipation of the last session, which is where we brought the jury per diem proposal. But I can certainly get a copy of that report for the committee.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I would appreciate that. And I also am, you know, we made a number of changes in 2023 that were meant to expand people's access to voting. So we had automatic voter registration, we had restore the vote. And so I'm curious if any of those things have made an impact on the diversity of our jury pools or brought more people in. And so I don't know if any study has been done with that regard, but that would be something I'm interested in as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Any comment on that, Mr. Shorba?
Madam Chair, Chair Mueller, I do not believe we've done an analysis on that, but I will check with our research staff to see if that can be easily done.
Thank you, Mr. Shorba, and your testifiers and the testifiers that were here today. Chair Levy, did you have a question? Oh, go for it.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. I was waiting to everyone else to get their questions in, but I do have some questions on this. And Mr. Shorba, my first question kind of goes back to this notice by publication. And I must say this is an issue that I've seen a number of times in my time here. It keeps coming back, and I think as technology changes. And it just occurs to me, this clearly there is a fiscal component to this as well. And the fiscal component doesn't get discussed. And I just wondered if you have an estimate of, clearly the courts would save money by not using the newspapers. Clearly the concern, part of the concern from the Newspaper Association is loss of revenue. So could you just address that so we can kind of get that elephant out of the room here?
It's a big elephant.
Chair Scott, Chair Liebling, on an annual basis, the judicial branch pays out to newspapers $250,000 a year, and it also takes a lot of time. I recognize the Newspaper Association is offering assistance, but our job is to find the newspaper and figure out where we're going to publish it, and then it's very complicated. We have to figure out with individual newspapers, and as she said, there are 242 of them. They all have their own billing systems. They all have their own ways to charge. Some take credit cards, some do not. They're working with a government entity. So our court administrators spend a lot of time finding the newspaper and then figuring out how to pay the newspaper, whether that's $50, $100, whatever. So there's a fiscal and a staffing impact here for us.
And Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you for that. And just to be clear, the proposal here is only for the notices the court itself has to post, not for any litigants' requirements to post.
Madam Chair, Chair Liebling, you're absolutely correct. This is only about notices that the court is required by statute or rule to post, not individual litigants.
Okay. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so next I want to ask a little bit about this conciliation court service simplification. So right now there's this limit of if the claim is not exceeding $2,500, the court administrator serves the summons for the litigant. And so when I look at that, I don't know what the original concern was behind this law, but it seems to me that this is something about that people with smaller claims tend not to have counsel. And so maybe you correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like the court staff there is helping people who tend not to have counsel. And then as the amount of the claim rises, it becomes more likely people will have counsel. And of course, if they have counsel, the counsel can handle it. it does give me some concern because I, you know, we, you started out telling us what the Constitution says about access to justice and so on, and it does concern me that, you know, it's very hard for people who don't deal with the courts, they have some dispute, it's a small dispute, to get access to justice. And when there are a lot of hoops for them to jump through and just paperwork and things, they, you know, I can imagine people not even understanding, you know, what is service? And I know that there are things available to help people, but I just want to state that that gives me pause as a way to reduce the court's workload, because I view that as a real helping the litigant, you know, the people who need the help the most right there. And I don't know if you want to comment on that and why you why that limit is there. Honestly, if I could, maybe, you know, I would honestly increase that amount. We inflate the other things, understanding that there is inflation, and, you know, to come in with a, you know, I'm sure lots of people with claims larger than this don't have counsel, because that's a pretty small amount these days. So anyway, I'd like to hear your response
to
that.
Mr. Shorba.
Chair Scott, Chair Liebling, you're absolutely correct. Most of the time in conciliation court, people do not have counsel, and the limit is $20,000. So you're absolutely correct. I don't want to dispute that inflation has gone up, and some of these claims have gone up as well, especially if it's about rent or car or something else, a bad business deal going on. What we're trying to do here is just to model what is done in all other civil cases, which is that the court does not do the summons. I don't know exactly why, I mean the notice service. I don't know exactly why the statute was phrased the way it is. We're just looking for uniformity so that when we are doing it, and we provide all kinds of help, especially to self-represented litigants about how to deal with various parts of their case, especially service, because one of the things we're cautious about is providing legal advice, but telling somebody how to serve something is not legal advice. So we do provide that information.
Yeah. Chair Liebling, it's interesting that he's saying that there's inconsistency in statute. I'm shocked by that. Go ahead, Chair Liebling.
I'm shocked that there's gambling going on here. Thank you, Madam Chair. And yeah, it's... It just strikes me that this might be, you know, I appreciate that the court wants to simplify and you have your administrative imperatives and budgetary imperatives, but, you know, this might be one of those issues where we as legislators have to be thinking about the people who don't have lobbyists and don't even know they need to be here and don't know this is going to be an issue for them, and that's kind of what I'm thinking about. So just flagging that, I'm not so sure I support that one.
Okay.
And then... So finally, I wanted to ask about this renewal of restitution judgments. Do you know, I mean, I have no problem with making it easier to renew that. If someone owes you restitution, I just wonder, why are we even making them renew it? Why does this expire before it's paid? Can we just fix this and say, let it not expire until it's paid? Or until the person comes back to court and gets relief from it in some way? I mean, why are we doing that to people?
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Chair Liebling, I'm not opposed to that. Section 541.04 of the statutes has been in place with a 10-year limit since 1907. I'm not taking a stance on that, but if you want to change that and make it until paid, I'm sure we would support that.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you. You said 1907.
07. Yes. That's what my notes
say.
Well,
goodness, we should never disturb anything that's been... No, seriously. I think maybe it's time to look at that. I don't know if there are any other, like, reasons why that might not be a thing we can do, but I think that would be really preferable. So I think we should have some more discussion about that and maybe when the bill comes back and to move out of committee, maybe we can fix that one. So thank you. Thanks for answering my questions. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And seeing no other discussion around the table, House File 3875, as amended, is laid over. So we will move on to our next item on the agenda, House File 3378, Schumacher. Mr. Chair, welcome to the committee. Looking forward to having you.
7.
Welcome, Chair Schumacher. And I will move House File 3378. What is the motion here? That it be passed and referred to the General Register. And we do have, Chair Schumacher, why don't you tell us what your bill does, and then we'll add the amendments, or talk about the amendments. And then.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I have to say that this moment is a precious one for me. It's a great opportunity to be back in front of the Judiciary Committee after 13 years of not being in the committee. So thank you for the warm welcome back. House File 3378 relates to a report that we recently received from the Department of Human Services regarding the process of prepayment review. So last fall, the Department of Human Services began a prepayment review process for 14 of their most high-risk programs to try and alleviate some of the payment and fraud issues that they're seeing. A report came back after the first bit of time in their efforts, and what we found in the report, and I believe the report is in your packets today, is that because they were citing Minnesota Statute 13.37, much of the report is redacted, including areas such as general vulnerabilities and policy recommendations. And given that we have a short time window this session to help the department with the policy recommendations and the matters that we need to, we sought out this bill to get the information unredacted for us so that we're able to use that information to put better policies together for the department.
Thank you for that explanation. Okay. All right. Before we go to amendments, I guess we're going to go to testifiers. Do we have anybody signed up? Mr. Ealing, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee. My name is Matt Ealing with Minnesotans for Open Government. I'd like to begin by noting that our organization supports Representative Schumacher's goal of getting more public data released from the Optum report. Those of us who spend a lot of time searching out government records, both state and federal, are frequently confronted with the problem of over-redaction, which you'll see in the DHS redactions made to this report. I've had a chance to review the redacted documents from that report in recent weeks, and I've provided one sample page from your packet for reference. On that page, you'll see that DHS has asserted Section 1337 as the basis for withholding data, as it has throughout the report. 1337 Subdivision 1A classifies security information, while 1337 1B classifies trade secret information, and I'll speak to those in turn. As a threshold matter, so folks understand how these classifications work, it's worth noting that the definition of trade secret information in Chapter 13 involves a multi-part test, and this test is far more strict than the comparable federal test under FOIA law. So to qualify for trade secret protection in Minnesota, the data must be a formula, pattern, program, compilation, et cetera, that was, one, supplied by the government to, supplied by the affected organization to the government. Two, it's the subject of efforts to maintain its secrecy that are reasonable. And three, it derives independent economic value from not being readily known. So if you look at the Optum report, you'll see that it primarily addresses review topics requested by the state. So this is a report that summarizes conclusions about state activities rather than being a summary of financial information or commercial information about the operations of Optum itself. So you can see this if you look at the sample that we've provided. Third column from the left says at the top, concerns and allegations. So concerns and allegations are something you'd expect to find in a report that summarizes allegations of fraud. So that would not qualify under the three-part, multi-part trade secret test. And the same is true of security information under 1337 1A. So data can only be withheld as security information If disclosure of the data would be, quote, likely to jeopardize the security of information, possessions, individuals, et cetera, against theft, tampering, improper use, et cetera, and other related metrics that are listed in the statute. So again, allegations can't meet this withholding threshold. So I would note that this report was provided to Minute also, and there could be possibilities that within the redacted sections, there's things like specific computer security information that could properly be withheld as security information. But if you look at some of the broad categories like conclusions or policy recommendations, there's going to be a lot of data in there that doesn't meet that threshold. So that's a very short summary of why we believe that there's a lot more public data that should be produced out of this report. You know, certainly the bill is one way to do that. We would also be happy to offer our services, which we do to members of the public, to simply write a letter to DHS outlining why their existing redactions don't work. And so we'd be certainly happy to help the committee with that as well. So I'm happy to take any additional questions. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Ealing, and please stick around in case there are sure. questions. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? All right, we will move to amendments. The first amendment we will take up is the A5, and that is Representative.
Thank you so much, Chair. And first, I sincerely appreciate the chairs and staff working so hard to get this language right. And I'm so glad that we're coming here today with this amendment. Chair Schumacher, thank you for the bill. As you know, in the first stop in Human Services, we're ready to go. We're ready to see this information so that we can do our jobs here. So what this amendment does is changes the language that would provide the Optum report to the public at large, which includes people committing fraud. It would limit the scope so that those of us legislators, where it falls under our jurisdiction, to find solutions for that, that we would have access to that, and that people committing fraud would not essentially receive a roadmap to fraud. We certainly don't want that to be available. So that is the meat of the amendment, and I hope all members support it.
Is there discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption of the A5, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Thank you, Representative Curran. Chair Liebling, the next amendment is yours, the A4. The A4 is before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The A4 amendment is quite simple. It really arises out of a concern of what Optum is doing with the data that it has access to. My understanding is it has access to a lot of very sensitive data that is held by the Department of Human Services, data on individuals. And we know that this medical data can be the most sensitive and concerning. So I put this forward. I frankly do not know if Optum is already contractually forbidden from selling the data or using it, but we do know that when companies use AI, that part of what happens is that AI is used to further be trained on data there. So AI, in my understanding, usually the use of AI often results in data being swept up and used for other things. So this might be a belt and suspenders kind of amendment. I'd love to hear from Optum or if Chair Schumacher knows if this is, you know, how serious a concern this might be. But if it isn't a concern, maybe this is just belt and suspenders and we should adopt it anyway. But what the amendment says is that Optum must not sell, share, or disseminate any private data on individuals that it receives under or incidental to this contract. So I'm just paraphrasing. But I'd love to really hear if there's any comment on this. Otherwise, I think I can't imagine that any of us would be comfortable with this data being, you know, sold, disseminated by Optum under this contract. So I think, you know, this is probably something all of us here can agree to if it isn't already happening. So love to hear.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Schumacher, I forgot to give you input on the last amendment. So here's your big chance now on the A4.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Liebling, for offering this. I'm not aware of anything within their contract. I looked at the contract briefly, or what parts had been released, but I don't remember this part being in there. I haven't heard any, since this amendment's been posted, any feedback or any resistance to it, and would take it as a friendly amendment for that. We did have a hearing in the Human Services Committee where we had Optum in and the department in to discuss the overall processes. I don't remember how you're talking about this. I don't remember that being a part of the discussion overall, so it's worthwhile to me to see that continue.
Right. Chair. Chair Liebling.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Schumacher, for that. And I just want to make sure that we formally move the A4, so I'm moving the A4. Mm-hmm. And I don't imagine that would have been discussed, just because this is the data committee, and this is where we think about these things, and we worry about people's private data going where it shouldn't go and so on. So would appreciate everyone's support on the amendment.
Any further discussion on the A4? Representative Ingen, you're on the list. Was it your question to this amendment?
No.
No. Okay, perfect. All those in favor of adoption of the A4, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Is there someone here from DHS? If so, please come to the table. And we will start with member questions. Representative Ingen, you're first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Schumacher. Bill, it's absolutely sad that we get this report and it makes the Epstein list look pretty tame. But the United Health Group was legislatively named and banned from overseeing Minnesota Medicaid managed care dollars last session because of previous billing concerns and conflicts of interest. And then we know Optum is a United Health Group owned entity. So this selection in and of itself may have been a conflict. Why were they selected in the first place and what led to that?
Are you asking the chair? Are you asking Chair Schumacher?
Anybody you can answer, including somebody from DHS.
Chair Schumacher or from DHS, please introduce yourself. And if you have an answer to that, please answer it. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Christy Graham with the Department of Human Services. Representative, at the time that we were implementing prepayment review, which was a provision that was funded and passed last year by the, I think it was in the Health and Human Services Committee conference, committee report. We were working on implementing that, and there were, at the time, I believe, four vendors that we identified that were CMS approved and that were able to do this kind of prepayment analysis. This was at a time when the Department of Human Services was taking a deeper dive and using data analytics in a way that we had never before to assess what was happening in terms of potential credible allegations of fraud in human services in the Medicaid program. As a result of that analysis, we found extremely concerning trends and patterns, and we had a need to implement this as soon as possible. So there were some time limitations that we were working under, and Optum was the only vendor that was able to meet those requirements. This is a year contract with Optum. The plan moving forward would be to issue a request for information to work with other vendors potentially out there to understand what functions of this work could potentially come in-house at the department and where do we need to work externally. And then from there, look toward competitive bidding for the next phase of prepayment review.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that information. Can you tell me a little bit about that vendor selection process? Are there a couple of individuals that might be in charge of doing that and determining who's going to be receiving that contract?
Ms. Brown.
Madam Chair, Representative Engen, I wasn't personally involved, but I believe the commissioner has been on record saying that she was involved in that process and was, obviously one of the key decision makers. I believe Minute was also involved in that vendor selection given the nature.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and that's exactly the issue. We have Minute, who did have a an agent there who was working on that vendor selection, and he was previously employed by Optum for over 20 years. So that might be an inherent conflict of interest when the people who are selecting those vendors are also they're also embedded within the organization that they're selecting. And then we receive this, which just has absolutely zero transparency in it. That shouldn't happen again. It should never have happened in the first place, and I would recommend that actions be taken to make sure that that doesn't happen again.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to pop in here for a minute and ask a few questions, and then we'll move on to the other members, because we've got a list going that's pretty substantial. So to Ms. Grom, I'm just wondering, did Optum request that that this report be redacted in any way?
Madam Chair, Optum did, well, there was a few different reports that Optum completed for the department, one of which was a claims editing system report, and the other was a vulnerability assessment, which I believe is the specific topic of the underlying
yes.
bill.
Yes, it is.
If I'm not mistaken. And my understanding is that the claims editing system report was the report that did have some trade secret information, and I believe that was identified by Optum legal counsel. I can certainly speak with our counsel to confirm who identified that particular data. So the other report, the vulnerability assessment, that was reviewed by DHS general counsel several times, and that was the report that contained the security data.
And so is one of those attorneys that was in on that redaction in the room?
Madam Chair, no, they weren't able to be here today.
They weren't able to be here. Okay. And so they were noticed. How many attorneys are there that went through the report and made those redactions?
Madam Chair, I can't say for certain. I don't want to give you inaccurate information here today.
Well, our staff asked for people to come here that could answer the questions. This is a committee that oversees these issues of data practices. And so I'm very disappointed that no one is here that actually was in on the redaction. To your knowledge, did Optum in any way communicate with DHS to ask to have the vulnerability report redacted for security information and for trade secret information?
Madam Chair, to my knowledge, Optum's legal counsel identified trade secret information. That's the information that I did not receive from Optum. That was what I received from our general counsel.
And so, Ms. Grom, was that on the vulnerability report or the other one that you mentioned? Because I thought initially you said it was the other one that Optum said, yeah, there's some trade secret stuff here.
Madam Chair, yes, that's my understanding, is that the trade secret data was in the CES report.
Okay, so we're talking about the vulnerability report here, the one that looks, it's black and white. So as Mr. Ealing laid out, and thank you for articulating that, when it comes to trade secret data, there is a three-part test. And so without an attorney here from DHS, we have no idea if they went through that three-part test. The second piece of that three-part test would almost certainly require that Optum reach out or that DHS reach out to them and ask them these questions. And so without having that any of those attorneys here, conveniently, we have no way of knowing if the law was followed here, if the data practices law was followed. I do know that when you blanketly in the report just on the page say that this is security slash trade secret data, that is not following the law. You have to go section by section and say which law is you're substantiating the redaction upon. So at the very least, your attorneys, whom I'm assuming, you know, I'm sorry they couldn't be here. I'm sure they're super busy. But please, refer to them. This tape, but we want them to justify. We want them to send a new copy of this report and go section by section on which part of the Data Practices Act they're claiming for the redaction, whether that's security, whether that's trade secret. And I also want to point out that if there's a sentence in a report that says, with the help of XYZ data or XYZ company or XYZ software, an internal, we are able to flag potential fraud, the only thing that you would redact in a sentence like that is just whatever that XYZ software or piece was that you're claiming to be trade secret. The entire sentence shouldn't be redacted. So I find it very curious that this report is so heavily, heavily redacted. And I'm not sure that you didn't, I don't think your attorneys follow the law. I think they're trying to hide something. But that's just me. We will move on to other member questions. Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's going to be tough to follow. I have a couple of questions, and I know this has been widely circulated throughout social media, but just if anybody in the public wants to see what we're talking about, this is the report. Everything is redacted, everything. If we go back to the recommendations of what, how we're supposed to fix this, it's redacted. And just as an example, I want to show you, I don't know if we're supposed to use props or not. This is an FBI report on UFO data, okay? This is a CIA report on 9/11. Less than 50% redacted. I understand that we're trying to protect privacy and trade secrets. I'm an IT guy from the private sector. I understand what, you know, the trade secrets would be. But to have a report like this, just completely everything blacked out, everything blacked, and like our chair said, there's ways to hide the data or cover the secrecies. You know, you could have person number one instead of John Smith. There's lots of ways to redact privacy data and trade secret data. This is not right, and I find it very. I had questions for your lawyers and for Optum, and is it Optum here?
Is there anyone in the room from Optum?
This is ridiculous. Why? Can you tell me what the lawyers are doing today? Do you know?
Madam Chair, Representative, I wasn't asked to bring the attorneys to this hearing. I was just emailed and asked if someone from DHS could attend. They are busy. I can assure you we are very busy at the moment, but certainly if there was a request for this committee specifically to hear from our attorneys, we will bring that back to them. Typically DHS General Counsel doesn't get involved in political matters, but I'm sure they would be happy to be here and describe to you some of the, you know, the process they went through to redact this report.
We just may very well do that.
I don't see this as a political issue. This is not a political issue. If it were political issues, this side and that side would be disagreeing on this, and I don't think we do. So I'd like an explanation from somebody that would have an answer on why this is redacted this way.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I support this. I have a quick question and then a comment. My question is for nonpartisan. So if once our members of the committee look at this, they are still bound, I believe, by the Chapter 13 requirements, and just want to make sure we put on the record what the penalties are for violations of Chapter 13.
To staff, Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Mueller, so legislators aren't subject to the Data Practices Act, so they wouldn't be subject to any penalties under Chapter 13. The amendment, the A5 amendment, provides that legislators or legislative staff must not disseminate or publicize any not public data they receive under this law should it pass. And in terms of penalties or enforcement, that would be handled either as an employment matter by the legislature for staff or through the ethics process for members of the legislature.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you for that. I'm a little concerned about that, and I wonder if we could talk about adding the reference into the penalties provision of Chapter 13 at some point. And then just a comment, I wasn't going to say anything, but the comment made that this makes the Epstein redactions look tame is incredibly disrespectful to the victims and survivors who were harmed by Epstein, the Epstein class, and government officials. In spite of the law, a law requiring disclosure in that case, many of the files remain hidden, including serious allegations against the president. There were public records that were there and have been removed. They also failed to redact names that identified victims and survivors. And you might have heard that Attorney General Bondi is called now to testify to the Oversight Committee. So we agree that with this bill that we need to, that there are too many redactions and we need to see it. But I just found those comments incredibly disrespectful to the victims and survivors in that case. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not even going to ask the question because I don't want to hear whatever ridiculous answer I would get. But the question I would ask is, what's the point of a report? Why do we spend, my understanding is we spent $2 million on this thing. You break that down, it's about $70,000 a page. And this is what we get for that money. The purpose of a report is to inform us of what's going on under the government that we legislate, and to inform the public. It's the whole reason for commissioning it. So I don't understand this process whereby a report is commissioned, it's produced. Strangely enough, the people who produce it and have presumably time to edit it and consider what it is that they produce discover that there are things in the report that shouldn't be known. Well, if that's true, then why did you put it in the report in the first place? So we got to redact that? And then for DHS to, through whatever process, which again, we don't know the process because we don't have the people here to ask what that process was, decide that when you're reading this report and it says general vulnerabilities include, and then it's a page of redactions, you get to recommendation, just redactions, redactions, redactions. You get to recommended policy. Redactions. That does nothing for us. It spent our money, but it did nothing for us, and it did nothing for the public. Here's the thing. If there's an argument against what we're doing here today, it has not been presented to us, and the people who could make it are not here. So our presumption should be unredact. That should be the presumption we start from. And I'm glad that it seems like the members around this table agree with that general premise. But it cannot be overemphasized how ridiculous it is and what an impact it makes on public trust in our institutions that we would spend this kind of money on a report, turn around and redact it, and then not even show up to explain why.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, Ms. Grom, I'm wondering if you got a report like that that you had commissioned and you were supposed to make decisions based on this report, what would you do? Would you be able to do your job?
Madam Chair, we, just to be clear, we don't oppose this bill. We've been on the record saying we don't oppose this bill. What our goal is to make sure that whatever passes out of the related to the Optum report or other, you know, other data that perhaps legislators we've heard want to see, that it doesn't provide a roadmap for criminals to exploit our systems further than they already have. So we support the goals of transparency. We also don't consider ourselves above the law. Our attorneys have looked over this information not once, not twice, multiple times, to even at the feedback that we've received from the legislature saying there's too much redacted. We've looked at it over and over to see what potentially could be bits and pieces that we could, you know, bring back and unredact. So I just want to be clear, we don't oppose this. We just want to work with the legislature to make sure that you can get what you need. I will clarify that policy has a broader meaning at the department. We have our own policy. For example, policy around how we post our provider policies on our website or in our various provider manuals. I'm not trying to diminish that there could also be policy recommendations for the legislature, but I do just want to clarify that for the committee's awareness.
Thank you. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate that members on the other side of the aisle share a lot of the concerns and passion that those of us in Human Services had when we had Optum in. And thank you, Chair Schumacher, for having Optum come in on a day that you had the gavel and letting members from both sides ask a lot of questions to Optum. As somebody who's, well, I think I'm the only member here who's members of both committees, and I can assure you that some of the, a lot of the comments made today are along the same lines that have been made in Human Services, not just at that hearing, but in just about every hearing thus far this year, as we're really itching to dig into the details of what this report and other information offers, because this kind of fraud is horrendous. The people who commit this kind of fraud are foul. We are here for a limited time to be able to address those issues, and without the information on specifically on vulnerabilities and information on the analytics that were used, because we know that some of those analytics were incorrect, and because the federal government had a timeline to submit information, we also know that DHS provided reports with inaccurate analytics, therefore inaccurate output, to the federal government, and the federal government is responding to inaccurate information as well. So there are a lot of reasons that committee members really need to dig into the details to make sure that we're writing legislation and policies that get directly to the issues that are buried under black here. So I sincerely appreciate all of the collaboration on this particular issue. I hope members can support this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Curran. Chair Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Schumacher, for your work on this. Ms. Grom, thank you for being here to take the weight of all of these questions, which you have a very tough job. Thank you for doing it. I have a lot of concerns about Optum. I'm really glad that we've come together around this transparency for this, for these reports, and having our members on Human Services be able to actually get this and do their work. I think that's very important. But I also just want to say that I have very little confidence in Optum for reasons that were raised here, actually. And I think that this report, I'm glad there's skepticism about Optum on both sides of the aisle, because the whatever this report is saying, however they did their work, it has the potential to help us as a state to address fraud, which is so important. We bipartisanly hate fraud and want to get it out of our programs. I know we all feel that way. Not one of us is okay with people stealing money that we have allocated to help people. Not one. But this report has the potential to either help us or to harm us, actually, because if the way they look at the data, they have a potential, and especially if we don't have a full understanding of what they're actually doing in their analysis, it has a potential to come up with things that are absolutely not true. And if, I think our state's been harmed a lot by a lot of the rhetoric against us and the wild claims of how much fraud there is that are completely without basis. And, yeah, we all know that we have to improve some things. We know that fraud has been a problem in our state. I don't doubt it's been a problem in a lot of other states. But this report has also the potential to put a bigger target on our backs that is unjustified. So I just really want to call that out. I think members on both of the sides of the aisle really have a stake in making sure that we solve the problem or problems that we have and not allow wild rhetoric, maybe even fueled by whatever Optum is going to tell us if they did it wrong, to make sure that we're not undermining the reputation of our state any more than it deserves to be undermined. I mean, we have had a reputation, I think, for many, many years as a very well-run state. And it is really sad that we missed seeing what was happening, and we missed dealing with it in a more proactive way in some cases. But I just really wanted to put that on the record, that I'm concerned about this both ways. And I'm really glad that our members, I hope this bill gets all the way to the finish line, because I think we as legislators really need to understand this from all of that perspective. What are they telling us? I also did want to just take a moment to say that this whole issue of proprietary information, I think many of us believe that needs a larger reform. And originally that was going to be part of this bill, and we decided not to try to open up that whole question here on this bill. But there is a real concern that I've had for many years, and I just want to state it briefly here. We hire private entities to run most of our Medicaid program. We hire we call them managed care organizations. They don't really manage care so much as they manage money. And what we give them, billions and billions of dollars, we as legislators have almost no visibility into what they do with our money because it's all proprietary. So I just want to flag that. This is a serious problem. Chair Scott and I have talked about it. This needs we need larger reform so that legislators can actually see and delve into some of this and make sure that this is limited. And anyway, I just wanted to say that. Thank you for the bill, Representative Schumacher. I really hope we can get this all the way to the finish line.
Thank you for the discussion here today. And Chair Schumacher, you have the final word before we pass the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members, for your help in the discussion on this today. We look forward to having a vote on the floor on this as well. And really do actually want to, the department has been helpful, or trying to be helpful, in this process here too. They haven't been stonewalling or anything like that in this. And so I think that was worth noting as well. So thank you and ask for your support.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. With that, I renew my motion that House File 3378, as amended, be passed and sent to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The bill is on its way to the General Register. Thank you, Chair Schumacher. And with that, we are adjourned.